You are listening to Fanthatrax.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
Greetings one and all, and welcome to Reaction Chat for Star Wars Andor episodes 11 and 12, brought to you by those freedom fighters over at fanfortracks.com. So you may remember we left Cassian and friends as they swam to safety after breaking out from an Arkina 5 prison, after they uncover the great Imperial deception. We rejoin Cassian hanging out with Malchi, and Andor learns of the passing of his adopted mother Marva. So Cassian heads back to Ferrix to say farewell to the woman he would learn to call mum, but waiting for him is not only the Imperial security hottie Deidre Miro, but also our mysterious rebel recruiter Luthen Rail, whose plan to Sintra and Vale in town to bump off Cassian before he could spill any of his Mexican jumping beans to the Empire. On the Imperial Center of Coruscant, Mon Mothma is facing an unwinnable situation by having to join her house with a sleazy oligarchical banker, Davil Skuldan, in order to keep her rebel fundraising efforts from being flagged by the Imperial Security. Season 1 of Andor comes to a close with Episode 12, Rick's Road, and joining me to go over his thoughts on Episode 11, 12, the first season of Andor, and what he thinks may happen in Season 2 is none other than that Grand Moff Fanfa, Mark Newbold.
God, where do you begin, miss? I know there's been a lot of mixed emotions about it online. Some people think it's too slow. Some people say there's not enough action. For me, week on week on week, it's a substantial sort of feast of Star Wars information and lore and history and just character building. It's been brilliant. And Daughters of Ferrix was fantastic because it's so teed up Rick's Road for what I think was one of the most emotional, engaging, eye-opening moments. Fantastic. I absolutely loved it. And I'm going to miss this show so much now for the next couple of years until it comes back. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, totally. One thing I'd like to predict is that actually now that all 12 episodes are in fact available, I wonder if there's going to be an uptick in people who are going to sit down and actually invest the time. Now that you can sit there and binge it over a weekend, it somehow doesn't necessarily feel like quite the time sacrifice as, you know, 12 weekly episodes. I think this has been a complete breath of fresh air for the Star Wars franchise. It's allowed for a lot more kind of mature storytelling to be developed. And I think also just a ton of world building in an area which is really rich already full of storytelling. But somehow this kind of has made it feel fresh and new, and that there could be so many different avenues that expanded universe storytelling and everything else could spin off from this one series. I think it's going to be fascinating to see how it actually affects Star Wars overall between now and when season two comes out.
When you think that when we came into it, we knew Cassian and we knew we were going to see his journey, inverted commas, but I didn't anticipate that we would get to know all these new characters and care so much about them. So now we come out of the back of that 10-week run, really, because we've got three episodes to kick it off, and care about Bix and her predicament, and care about Marva, and obviously she's passed, but the legacy that she's left, you know, and care what Cyril gets up to next, and want to know what Deidre Miro does next, and want to know what General Partagas does next. And so we've got all these brand new characters that, you know, 2 months ago we'd never heard of, and now we're so invested that this wait for the next chunk of Andor, well, the final chunk, you know, it's only a 2-season show. It's just going to feel like forever. That's what's impressed me. You know, we've got the great new soundtrack from Nicholas Patel. Brilliant new soundtrack. I'm playing it to bits at the moment. And the visuals have been ridiculously gorgeous. The design, the set work on Ferrix, specifically Ferrix, has just been brilliant.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're totally right. I think the one thing that I've really liked is the physicality of this series, and by that I'm not just talking about the fight scenes, I'm talking actually about the fact they're using physical sets. Having seen some of these sets up front in person, you know, these aren't small sets. These are massive, whacking great big investments in people's time, skill sets and money to develop and build. So I've really enjoyed seeing how everything is coalescing. For me, it's felt like the most authentic Star Wars we've had since Rogue One, but before that, Return of the Jedi. They've really hit the correct balance between the need for CGI and also live action. Just when they're walking around the town and you get to see into all those little shops and there's people just in there and there's like a chap just sat there, you know, like a nameless casted extra who's just there just working on a droid or something like that. And it's just like the depth is just immense that they've put into this just to make this feel really authentic and really feel like a complete environment, which for me has really kind of made it feel really engaging. It's interesting because, like, overall, Andor, even at the beginning of the series, probably up until about episode 9, or I wasn't too fussed about him, to be fair. It was the other characters that I was more invested in. But then when Marva died, and knowing that he wasn't able to be by her side, and then knowing where he was going to end up in episode 12, in respect that he was going to go back to Ferrix, it was pretty clearly and obviously signposted. That just made it more emotional. You know, the initial opening scene of pulling her out on the gurney and stuff like that, it didn't resonate with me emotionally as such, because I think it was kind of on the cards pretty much since the first episode. But it created that anchor point for him to be pulled back to Ferrix, which without that, I think it would be harder for the storytellers to find a convincing way to really have to come back and rescue Bix. And for me, that was quite an interesting kind of evolution in my own viewership. Generally with Star Wars, I watch a series or I watch a film and my initial thoughts and impressions of a character is pretty much what I would take with me for the entirety of that film or series. And also with Lufen, I think Lufen is one of my most favourite characters. That character deserves either its own series or definitely his own book, because I'm absolutely fascinated to get even deeper into his mindset and to find out more about the motivations behind what actually has put him on this path to begin with.
Yeah, it does feel like James Luceno needs
absolutely
to be in the call,
yeah,
doesn't it, to do a Lucian book. Dedra, not so much. She's an up-and-comer in a way that Cassian's an up-and-comer. She's further up her ladder. Clearly, she's top-table ISB, but she's on a journey in her career. I mean, like The Mandalorian, for example, you can't deny the lone gunslinger. You picked up pretty quick the lone wolf and cub thing, because, like, goodness knows, you know that way out before the thing even started. So you go in with him being this solitary sort of quest. What we would have expected from Boba Fett is what we got with The Mandalorian. So that's kind of set to a degree, and we've seen a bit of progression. You see a lot of progression in terms of what you know about the culture, and you see him soften to Grogu. So there's a certain amount of growth in those two seasons and the two episodes of Book of Boba Fett, because there's not been an awful lot of other stuff come out. With Andor, he starts off as a character I found not particularly likable, and I think that's completely done on purpose. He instigates a lot of stuff. He's too quick to act. But the great thing is, and you hear it through these two episodes, and you even hear the manifesto, you see Cassian reading the manifesto himself, listening to the words, that a lot of what's happening, it's not just happening to him, it's happening to other people all around the galaxy, and even though they're not connected yet in a formalised alliance, there's little sparks of rebellion, which is still such a perfect title for anything, happening, and it's just whether somebody can pull them together. You mentioned Luthen, and he feels one of the playmakers that's going to make these things happen. You've seen him talking to Saw, they both know Anto Krieger. There's a connection already, beyond what the people on Aldani knew, what was in that manifesto. I think the manifesto is a higher concept almost than the details.
It's almost like the kind of MacGuffin in some respects. It's, you know, it's a Marcellus Wallace suitcase with the golden light in it. It's like you don't actually necessarily need to know or hear huge blocks of what's in that text. But actually then what we did get in Rex Road was very compelling, because again, it was selected in a way that was very resonative with Andor at that point in time. So you kind of think about how you know, what else is in there? It's a book of principles, maybe even as a recruiting tool, perhaps. And you know, there must be loads of people who would have similar concepts or at least similar kind of ideas, but maybe not be able to verbalize them and construct them in such a precise kind of way like they did in that journal.
Hi, this is Hugh Quashie. I've had great pleasure in recording this interview for Fan4Trax.
In Daughter of Ferrix, obviously Marva passes away. We don't see it. We see the aftermath. We see the house. We see B2 despondent. And the whole funereal feeling of that, which plays off perfectly in Rick's Road, I saw last week, because we haven't seen the whole story, people make assumptions about what they're going to see. So some people last week were a bit underwhelmed by the fact that she died and you didn't see the death.
The emotional impact is that holographic projection that B2 produces in episode 12. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? I think I'd like to think anyway, going into season two, I think bizarrely, I think people would be a little bit more understanding of what to expect or what not to necessarily criticise based on a singular episode. Bearing in mind that the whole of season two is meant to be in these three episode blocks. So therefore, you kind of know that you've got a mini trilogy format. So you know that you're going to have a setup, downbeat, downer, tension, increasing, ratcheting, middle episode, and then obviously resolution for the third episode. So you do that three or four times and it makes sense. I like the character Marva, but I wasn't emotionally invested in her. But I can, obviously, I feel for Cassian. And also, I kind of wondered at the start of the series why they called the droid B2 Emo. And now it's clearly, you know, a little bit on the nose. It's because he's very much aware of his own emotions and the fact that he's kind of alone. That despondent or sad, upset, it's bizarre in some respects to kind of like use these words to describe how a droid, a machine, is actually acting. But yet, yeah, we've seen this time and time again in Star Wars that actually it's the droids that sometimes make the viewer emote the most. You know, you think of K2SO in Rogue One. Yeah,
or 3PO in the original trilogy, you could argue he's the most emotional character out of all of them. He's outwardly, you know exactly what he's thinking. He's got no guile. He can't hide his feelings. It's out there on his red or gold sleeve, whichever one you want to pick. Like with all the characters, really, you know, the show's called Andor, and to a degree, it is about building up that character to where he gets to in Rogue One. But in Rogue One, he's part of a larger team. And I think we said when we knew this show, we've known this show's been coming pretty much as long as you and me have been doing this podcast. It's the one I was looking forward to the most, not because of the character, but because of the era that it set. And I just got a feeling that we were going to see what the Empire was doing and how they were stamping their authority in the galaxy and how these little factions were coming together. Never anticipated a character like Luthen. Never thought we'd get into the sort of kitchen sinkiness of Marva and the home life and the family dog of B2, and just a lot of little things that just felt very real world and rootsy in the best way. Because when you get to Rick's Road and you see the funeral processions meet in the square and the whole ceremony of it, I love the opening of that episode with the music, the opening music, Patel doing unique music at the start, as he has for every other episode. And it was those sort of brass bands, and I'm a total sucker for brass bands, they choke me up. Probably one of the reasons why I love the Solo Saw. That's very brass heavy and it just works beautifully. That was the same. The centerpiece scene in Rick's Road, the funeral, the hologram, the speech. I was quite emotional. It kind of got to me a little bit, which I didn't anticipate. I have seen the episode about three times because I was lucky enough to see a screener of it. So I had seen it before today. But nevertheless, the impact of that was really surprising.
I was sat at work watching it in my edit suite, and I've got a big sky glass, 65 inch, which is on like a set of wheels, a bit like, you know, how you used to have it on school. And it's set at a height where you have to view the TV standing. For stuff like Andor, I found that actually if I sit on the back of a sofa, which is up against a wall, that's a perfect height. As I was watching it, I was kind of leaning into the screen because I started to feel like I was slipping off the edge of the sofa. You know, it was the emotion of what she was saying, the, you know, the absolute pure honesty of what she was saying, combined with the images of, you could see the Imperials kind of just all stood around, just kind of like, you know, especially the officers who are, right, okay, at what point are we just going to go in and just cut this off? Because this is getting, you know, a little bit kind of contentious of what she's saying. And so, like, it's that notion of, like, something's going to happen, when's it going to happen, and who's going to basically fire that first shot. It was great, but it was the Empire just coming in, trying to silence somebody, quite literally just by putting the cloak of the Empire over the holo projection.
But didn't you think, and I thought it was really telling, that you've watched that officer, the one that said, fire at will, you know, just loses it because he's been attacked. The fear in his eyes, the fear in Dedra, she's shaking with fear. She thinks she's done. God knows what she thinks is going to happen. But I'm pretty sure she's thinking near the end that she's being dragged off and they're just going to shoot her. Because it's the classic general sitting in a bunker, moving battalions around on a chessboard, essentially, and never having to see up close what these people go through. And it felt to me like this was almost the first time, certainly with Dedra, because she's an intelligence officer. She's not a soldier. That she was seeing this for real for the first time, and her terror was visceral, and it was almost the most visual display of terror that you saw in the whole episode, and it came from an Imperial. But when they put the riot shields up, starts to kick off. Brasso whacks that one guy with Marva's stone. You know, he takes somebody down with the stone, and it starts to kick off. But I was, first time watching it, thinking, oh, here we go. They're just going to light them up. And they didn't. They put the riot shields up. They were holding them back. It wasn't until the officer felt threatened and just loses it. And as soon as he says the words open fire, then all those stormtroopers start. I thought that was really interesting. It wasn't just black and white. It'd be very easy just to imagine that they just laid them out. Like you see in Rogue One, when you see the AT-ST on Jeddah, tanks blown up, and there's that whole beautiful shot looking down. And there was a similar shot in this with Luthen looking down, but you can hear the gunshots and see the flashes.
I think the highlight for me, anyway, was there was this one stormtrooper who was just leaning up against like a doorway just as things start kicking off. And it was not until the officer kind of turns to him and says, oi, go and get in there.
Get that guy down.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, I lean a lot, especially in costumes. Because again, it kind of just shows how there was a certain level of lapsy-daisiness about the Empire as well. And, you know, that kind of hubris and general kind of casualness that actually, whatever, you know, these little people are going to do, doesn't matter, because with the Empire we can kind of sort it out. But ultimately it will always end up with somebody firing the first shot, and the fact is it was the Empire. And I think for me anyway, this was probably, and I've said this all along, I think, about the series, is that I was kind of hoping to see the actual start of the rebellion. And what we've learned through this series is that actually there isn't one defining moment that starts the rebellion as a whole, but it's a defining moment that starts a rebellion on a system. And we got to see that, which I thought was fascinating. Saw Gerrera's already set up, he's running, Anton Krieger's guys are set up and then get wiped out in episode 12. They're set up, and all these other kind of partisan and separatist alliance, anybody against the Empire, they're all kind of seem to be set up. They all seem to be maybe vying for their own superiority in amongst the rebel cells. It was interesting to see this at the kind of the grassroots level, just having started with an old lady's words.
Totally. And you saw that in Daughter of Ferrix about the struggle within the factions when Luthen goes to see Saw Gerrera and totally plays him. I mean, Saw's set to do one thing, and the way that Luthen kind of turns it around, and then there's that classic Rogue One paranoia of Saw Gerrera when he's looking around his own people. What, have you got spies here? You've got spies everywhere. You either know there's a spy in the ranks of the ISB or you're the spy. What is it? And Luthen's playing his cards close to his chest like he always does, and then blames two tubes. Poor two tubes, you know. And just playing Saw like a fiddle, which was fascinating because we see Saw Gerrera in Rogue One. We see his end on Jeddah. We're not on Jeddah yet. Again, I think that's the exciting thing. And it's a little bit, I find with this, it's a little bit like season two of Andor will be like your original trilogy. But season one, even though it was made first, was the prequels. And you kind of needed the prequels to underline and underscore and explain to a degree why you saw what you saw in the OT. But of all of those episodes in the prequel trilogy, the one that really actually does it the most is Phantom Menace, which is the one that everybody says, he didn't need to make that. We should have just started in the Clone Wars, because some people just want pew, pew, bang, bang lightsabers. George was always about the motivations. And with season one of Andor, it's been so cleverly written. If you could pick, and we could easily, but if you pick 10 things, I pretty much guarantee 9 of them have had an answer to a greater or lesser degree. It doesn't feel like an awful lot's overhanging into season two, other than Cassian's sister. That's the one big thing that hasn't really been mentioned since. But this is one of those shows where Marva says to Cassian, don't go looking for your sister. You won't find her. It could very well happen that she is actually already dead, and there's no great Scooby-Doo mystery to Cassian's sister other than he really wanted to find her. And there's just been so many things in the show that have played out and had some sort of logical resolution. But that Saw Gerrera moment was priceless, because you know that's going to play into season two. Again, it's another one of those factional things.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
The one thing that I feel is slightly been a little bit understated in the last couple of episodes, in some degree anyway, is the whole Mon Mothma story arc a little bit. I think it's just a little bit subtle, maybe a little bit too subtle. It's been great and really enjoyed watching it as a character study for Mon Mothma in that period of time. But I just kind of wish it maybe gone just a little bit further. I even feel like what we got in Rick's Road, you know, the revelation about her husband gambling.
That whole sequence in the taxi, she knows that the driver is ISB. She said it. She knows he's spying on her. Logically, a smart woman would know that if she says, give us privacy, then he's not going to really give them privacy. Do you think that everything she was saying to Perrin was an actual accusation that she could back up? Or is she saying that for the benefit of the taxi driver who then takes it back to the ISB guy? Because it feels like she's made the decision. You saw a daughter do the whole thing at the table with her friends the previous episode, learning the old ways, doing the speeches and the cultural thing. And Vel comes on and says, you're not preparing her for being introduced to somebody, are you? Oh, well, she's got her own mind. This isn't coming from me. It's coming from her. And so for Mothma, she can rationalise in her head that, okay, my daughter is actually prepared to do this old Chandralan custom and go down this pathway. And the boy that she's meeting, her father, is unbelievably wealthy. And in terms of station and standing and security, she would be set. Her daughter would be set in a logical way. But Mothma can rationalise that because it's a means to an end that means that the rebellion can be funded on the quiet and it can all carry on. But also that she's kind of throwing Perrin under the bus. You've got a Canto Bight to do whatever you want to do. I don't need to see it, but don't do it on Coruscant kind of thing. Do you think then that he actually was gambling?
I wonder if maybe he's had a gambling problem in the past that they've had to deal with. And this is, at that point in time, maybe one of the ways that she's going to try and explain away that 400,000 credit hole. It's him who, has kind of like pulled the money out, you know, and or she's had to pull that money out to cover his debts. But then, you know, on the flip side, then if that was the case and that was the solution, it felt a little bit too subtle for that to be the resolution for the story arc. Then there would be no reason for her to betroth her daughter to Darvin's son. It's that interesting kind of thing that happens with generations. You've got the mother who is very much anti the establishment and the sense of traditions, where it seems like Perrin is a little bit more supportive of that. And that obviously because their daughter is more, I wouldn't say daddy's girl, but certainly prefers her dad over to her mum. The betrothal of her daughter to Davos's son is only going to lead to, I think, extra stress leading into season two, I would think. And again, this is the thing, is that kind of need to look at this timeline and look at where in the overall Star Wars timeline do the events of Rebels happen, where she makes that big proclamation and actually brings all the different cells together. I'm guessing that's closer to the end of the series. And so I'd think that when we return to Andor in a couple years' time, we're still going to see Mon in the Senate. But again, maybe now she's having to deal with the underworld in a way that she didn't necessarily hope she would have to. If we do that, then that's just it and we move on. But, you know, if her daughter then does get married to the guy's son, then that is obviously, you're now one conjoined family. So therefore, what happens to one side of the family could affect what happens to the other side, especially when it comes to politics and reputation.
That's a really good point, because we see this on both sides, really, with Imperial sides and Rebel sides, that the Rebels have worked with bounty hunters and smugglers, and the Imperials have certainly worked with plenty of bounty hunters. We saw that as far back as Empire and even further, I think, in the Marvel run. So the underworld is definitely going to play a part in a lot of what goes on, because that is galaxy-wide, and that is probably more organised than the Rebellion at this point. Probably not as well organised as the Empire, but, you know, we've seen that in these episodes, these two episodes, that whilst you have an Empire that's most of the galaxy, or at least the important parts of the galaxy, and it's strip mining the bits that it needs from everywhere else, you can chip away at the Empire, and they think they're confident in their power, so they're complacent. I mean, that goes right back to the first few episodes of, you know, when Cassian and Luthen first meet. You know, Luthen gets a measure of Cassian by him saying, you know, they're not expecting us to walk in their house, that whole speech. It'll be interesting to see how that does play out, because if Mon has got to deal with that side of it, if the father-in-law, inverted commas, starts to renege a little on his deal and gets a sense, he's a smart guy, wouldn't be where he is if he wasn't, gets a sense that there's more going on than just clearing some old debts and ledgers. You know, he says he doesn't need to know, but you wonder, at what point will he want to know? Where does that, like you say, where does that take Mon Mothma? Because there is what happens in Rebels to take into account, and it is kind of happening nearby, and the first year of Andor, the show, has taken place over a number of months. We don't really, it's like, how long are Han and Leia in the asteroid field sort of thing? How long was Luke on Dagobah? How long was Cassian in the prison on Narkina 5?
Do you know what? I think there was one mention from the ISB agents at some point in one of the episodes that suggested that it had been a year. I think either from that skirmish in Ferrix, or at least the start of the Rebels kind of stealing kind of ship parts and stuff from the Empire. I think that was about a year, I think. But they've kind of kept it vague, which is kind of interesting because we know the next season will be 4, 3, 2, 1 years, basically, I guess. I would think it's got to be a year or so. I mean, he was in the prison, I think, for at least, 45 days, actually. So that's not a huge amount of time. You know, there, again, there's also his other jumps after he escaped Eldani. You know, how long was he out on the beach for? Because it sounds like he hooks up with that bird. Now, if you've just knocked off an Imperial garrison, the last thing you do is you just go and put on your Crocs and then go and get a Nesquik from like the local one-stop. You'd have to be comfortable in your surroundings to do that, and comfortable that you're not likely to get picked up. So there's probably clues, and I'm sure there will be a timeline. Wouldn't it be great if we got a visual dictionary? You know, we saw a quad jumper in Daughter of Ferrix. By far, the standout characters of that episode is those two brothers. The Pamela brothers, two of my favourite, you know, incidental characters in the whole of this season, because they were just awesome, partly because of, like, the size of the moobs one of them's got. It's ridiculous.
But that was a brilliant scene, because when Cassian and Melchie get captured, it was so out of the blue. Mike Quinn, wasn't it? Mike Quinn doing the voice and doing some of the facial puppeteering, which was brilliant. But that whole sequence was amazing, because he'd had that opening when they're still on Narkina 5 and they're hiding from that TIE Reaper trying to stay on the cliff, and Melchie's starting to think, oh, my fingers are going to sleep, I'm going to fall off this cliff. And then later in that episode, that fantastic sequence with the Cantwell class, you know, shooting out the countermeasures, the lightsaber-type beams coming out of the sides of the ship. So many cool moments in that whole exchange. And the fact that, okay, he's got this amazing shipboard computer, David Collins does the voice, helping him to do what he needs to do. And it was a red flag when he says, I'm flying this thing on my own. You know, I'm sure the officer would have thought, that's kind of irregular. You know, most ships generally need a co-pilot. But that whole sequence was just absolutely fantastic. Not only because we got to see that ship, which a lot of fans know was like one of the original Star Destroyer designs. Well, you didn't see it, but it was made for Solo. But I think it was a cut scene, so you never got to see it, if I remember. Taking out the TIE fighters, just the way he did it, then just leaps to hyperspace.
Those countermeasures, it seems like they were pretty specific to one task. So you kind of think Lufin has a good idea or understanding of the kind of things that he's going to run into and how is he going to escape. You pull this trick once or twice and that's it. You know, it doesn't matter if you change the transponder or the name of your vessel. People would be like, hang on a sec, we've heard about this ship. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? You know, so he clearly knows the kind of things that he's likely to run into. Okay, this is the kind of countermeasures that the Yiva Falcon could have done with, because, it's all about trying to disrupt the tractor beam. So these things do cost money. And also, it's not only do they cost money to probably be able to acquire them, because you need to know have the contacts and you need to be able to find someone who can fit them. It's not like you just ordered like a pair of 6x9s to stick on your parcel shelf, or, you know, new speakers or something like that for your car. This is like something very specific. See, it's that whole thing, just because we haven't seen it doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't exist. And probably now it means that actually we're going to go back to, I don't know, High Republic comic, and a ship will kind of have something similar. And then you'd be like, oh, okay, that's right. And because they've had it for a couple of hundred years and part of Star Wars canon from now on. It was nice because actually we haven't seen a huge amount of starfighter combat and dogfighting. In fact, we haven't really seen anything. The only time we really saw anything was really on Eldani, and they were just kind of trying to escape. So actually seeing this was quite nice, because it was kind of a breath of fresh air. It was something that we're so used to seeing a lot of starfighters and base combat. So actually to see this in this context, when we haven't had any or very little in the series, I think made it stand out. Kind of like energy weapons that he had, which kind of like just cuts those ties in half as he's kind of doing the barrel roll, I thought was absolutely amazing. One of the best scenes I've seen in Star Wars, at least this year, for sure.
Do you think then that as we roll out of season one, all the characters are in place? Cyril's now with Dedra, Cassian's now with Luthen, Bix is now with Brasso and those people with B2. So people are in their places for season two. And one other thing I think is that I don't think season two will start that long after the end of season one because of what we just said, that season one does actually cover quite a long time. And if the first three episodes of season two is year 4 to 3, let's say, which is how they kind of say it will be, and we'll probably get those in one chunk in a couple of years' time, so you'll get year 4 in one go. Do you think then that because we've had some action sequences now, and it's not a show known for action, so when you do get action, it really stands out. And I don't think that's a budgetary thing. I think if they wanted to show it, they could show it as much as they like. Do you think then that we'll start to see, pick a silly example, you'll start to see more X-Wings, you'll start to see U-Wings, you'll start to see the tech that we know. We end the episode, indeed, the season, with the freaking Death Star, which is like, what a statement that is, as a finale after the end of the credits. And if you didn't watch till the end of the credits, please go back and do it. Just feels like that really did tighten the nut towards saying this is Rogue One territory we're heading towards now.
Yeah, and I think it's been quite nice, actually, how they haven't been hitting us over the head with, oh, what's the Empire building? Oh, there's something going on. You know, there was that one reference in one of the prison episodes where Cassian kind of goes, you know, I don't know what we're making or what it's for exactly. And then to see it at the end like that is a nice way to frame actually where we are and what's, you know, what the stakes are. And it's a great way to tease up the next series. One of those things that potentially we could see Cassian's mission is to find out what he was building, what they were being used for. We've seen in a couple of instances where the Empire has strip-mined completely a whole planet. So you kind of think these are the conversations that Luthen and Cassian maybe have. I'm sure they have all the metaphysical talk about toppling governments and stuff like that. But you kind of think when it comes down to it, it's going to come down to the insurgency and actually trying to find ways in which you can topple that government. And one of those is actually figuring out what they are doing and potentially if they are building something, what are they building? The actual physical build-up of the Rebel Alliance, however, is an interesting thing. And I wonder if that is more of a Mon Mothma thing. I wonder if that is more of a negotiation whereby she's actually pulling people and resources onto their sides rather than the actual physical act of theft, yeah, shall we say. And we just see, I think, an episode of Rebels where they grab some Y-Wings from being smelted, yeah, down and stuff. All that kind of stuff is going to happen. However, they will probably try and keep it on a similar kind of pattern, or at least to begin with. I mean, because ultimately they've got to end up on Yavin, so they've got to have a certain fleet of ships, and in fact a fleet in general, because you think of all those ships that ended up fighting over Scarif. That wasn't a small fleet by any stretch of imagination. You know, for me anyway, going into Rogue One, I kind of assumed that they didn't have any fleet per se. They just pretty much had those fighters and that was it. What we saw in Yavin was basically what they had. They almost threw everything at it. You could have a tragedy of Cassian maybe wanting out, you know, if there's a romantic kind of connection between him and Biggs, to actually leave the fighting and get away from it all. And the irony is that actually the mission that he goes on at the beginning of Rogue One is meant to be his last mission. Deidre Mira, yeah, I almost thought, are they going to get it on? Are they going to, you know, I don't know if it's because I've just watched way too much Grey's Anatomy in the last few weeks, where they just seem to do everything in those kind of store cupboards other than actually get medical supplies out of them. This is what sets up, yeah, Cyril Khan into being the ISB officer that we, you know, expected him to be in episode one. So I think he'll be wearing white uniform or definitely Imperial uniform when we next see him.
Hi, this is Dave Chapman, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
We kind of know where Luthen's taking this. More pieces are coming into it, so he's got a more delicate balance. Ferrix happened, so obviously that's put the Empire even more on guard. Partagas says that the whole point of what they did with Anto Kariga was to take the taste of Aldani out of the Emperor's mouth. It makes you wonder what sort of taste this will put in the Emperor's mouth, or whether it will just be viewed as a local skirmish until they sort of break it down and figure out the moving parts. But it did very, very much feel like everybody came together for a purpose in this episode. But going out of this, Cassian now, kill me or take me in. Because Cassian's got nothing to lose now. He was doing a lot of this for his mother.
Correct.
He can't go back to his home. His friends have left. He's sent them away for their own safety. There's nothing left for him on Ferrix anymore. When we go into season two then, do you think we will see a more focused Cassian, a bit more together? Because one thing that I think Jyn brought out in Cassian, because of her situation, because she's related to the guy that puts the fuse in the Death Star and all the other elements that play into Jyn's story, Cassian and her are very much kindred spirits, and it's almost like they spark something off within themselves. And it makes me wonder whether Jyn reminds Cassian of Bix, or there's some elements that are playing there. When he gets to the guy that he is in Rogue One, you know, it's just as lethal. You saw it in this episode in Rick's Road when he takes down that Imperial, just shoots him in the chest, bang. He's not missing it. He does that. We've seen him do that a lot. So that lethal killer elements, that's him. That's there. He did it in episode one. But what sort of Cassian do you think we'll find in season two?
He's going to be more focused and at least more engaged with a rebellion. Like you said, there's no reason for him to go back to Ferrix, but he hasn't really got anything to lose now. The one kind of bit of moral kind of center that he had, which was Marva, is basically gone. So now I think you're going to find him pretty much all in the rebellion, you know, and that'll be the cool thing. I kind of hope that we have that kind of cold start opening where we pick up halfway through a mission, you know, no dicking about, just straight into seeing what is going on. And for me, it's going to be interesting just to see how far they can push him, how far they can push the blunt instrument before he turns around and says, this is too far. Because it's that whole unsettling reality that I think we've had to deal with in this first season of actually the rebellion, as much as it's great for all its ideals, has to be dirtier, has to be bloodier, because they have to get over the Empire. And the only way you can do that is, unfortunately, you've got to put the knife in the back and you've got to shoot them in the chest. And so therefore, I'm really excited just to see how Cassian is going to take on this extra role as Fulcrum, and see how that name comes about. You know, we've got Axis already. Is Fulcrum actually something that the Imperials give him? Is that the name that he is kind of given by the Imperials? You've got Axis, now you've got Fulcrum. Is it he who is going to be shifting the balance from system to system? Only time will tell.
Thanks for listening to Making Tracks. If you want to be a part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, visit FanthaTracks.com or check out the free FanthaTracks app through the App Store to follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Comment, like and share on any of our social media feeds at FanthaTracks. And be sure to subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, for your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semple for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our Making Tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Remember, tune into Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on Facebook and YouTube, and check out our FanthaTracks Radio Friday night rotation every Friday night at 7 p.m. UK time for new episodes of the Phantom from Down Under, Planet Leia, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks. And that's me done for this episode.
Everybody else, stay safe, take care. Thank you very much for listening. May the Force be with you.
Coming up next on FanthaTracks Radio, it's Start Your Engines.